Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
First, Taoiseach Micheál Martin, you're very welcome to the programme and to the studio. There's been outrage expressed from all quarters about what happened in Belarus yesterday. You've said yourself it was utterly unacceptable. Would you describe, though, what happened to this journalist and activist, Roman Protasevich, as state-sponsored hijacking?
Well, it certainly is a state-sponsored coercive act, and it did forcefully force that plane to land in order to arrest Protasevich, and that is absolutely unacceptable. I think it reflects a growing authoritarianism across the world, but also these authoritarian leaders taking premeditated decisions of this kind, and the European Council will meet later this evening and tomorrow and will have to respond very strongly to it. I'm meeting my Lithuanian counterpart, Gitanis, and Kyriakos, the Greek Prime Minister, later this evening. They sought a meeting with me and in advance. So I think there's going to be a very...
They didn't seek a meeting with you about this subject, did they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they want to talk to me about this later this evening, obviously from their perspective as two other countries directly involved in this.
Because of Ryanair, is it? Or why did they seek out a meeting with you?
To discuss how we should coordinate a response in the broader EU meeting. And they have very strong views in terms of this. And already there are sanctions against some of the Belarus leaders. The issue will be, will there be a graduated response, stronger response from the EU Council towards the regime, mm-hmm. Both in terms of sanctions and indeed other measures that the European Union will want to take.
Okay. Because you'd wonder, though, whether sanctions are a good idea, because they would result in further isolation and further entrenchment of their position and a move perhaps closer to Russia.
Well, I think there has to be measures that respond firmly to an act of this kind, which put the crew and the passengers at risk. It put their safety at risk, this kind of behaviour. It's piracy in disguise, and it's just not acceptable. I mean, there are international rules there. And they have to apply. And, you know, consistently as a country, we've always been of the view that international rules-based organisations should exist. There has to be a basic system of international rules. And this flies in the face of all of that.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to this, the cyber attack, because today has been described as D-Day in relation to the attack on the HSE. The hackers threatened, as we know, to release a lot of information. Now, I'm sure you're aware that over the last week there have been WhatsApp messages flying around saying that the data is already out there, medical data, people hearing anecdotal examples. I've had messages myself on this. Is that happening? Is the data out there?
Well, there's no great evidence yet of any mass dumping of data. You know, as you know, the National Security, Cybersecurity Centre, the Gardaí, the HSE have teams now scouring you know, the net to keep an eye on this and to monitor this very, very closely. If anybody has any suspicions, if anybody comes across any data, and if you see it, you know, don't share it, report it. That's the simple message we have. Mm-hmm. Report it to the Gardaí. So there's two strands to this. Fundamentally, we want to get services back as quickly as we possibly can. Progress has been made on that. The key is helping. The key that was given back is helping. So in terms of hospitals like the Mater, Tala, and James's in Beaumont, you know, they're getting services back on a gradual basis. Radiology is coming back, the NIMAS system.
Do you know why they gave back that key, the decryption key?
I don't. I mean, there's speculation as to why.
Because they wanted 20 million. I mean, that seems to be a given.
We're very clear we're not paying a ransom. Mm-hmm.
That was the demand, wasn't it, 20 million?
I don't have the specifics of that, but they did. Obviously, they didn't steal. It's a despicable act to steal someone's data. Now, they may not have realised that they had taken on an entire state or a government or a health service, but the data is perhaps where they see some value. So far, we haven't seen any significant dumping of data.
The information that we're talking about can be hugely sensitive. I mean, we're talking about sexually transmitted infections or addiction records or so on. And the advice is to report that if you're asked or if you're extorted on the basis that information is out there. Now, a lot of people won't want to report that to the Gardaí, will they?
Many may not and will not, but I think this, you know, I mean, that is the nature of this threat and this attack. It is criminal. These are criminals who will seek to exploit this data. But again, we've had very good cooperation with the social media companies who have been very proactive with the government in relation to this and have agreed, you know, to shut down anything and take it down as quickly as they see anything. The mainstream media likewise has been very cooperative and proactive in support of this broader agenda to resist this. And we have a High Court injunction as well, which makes it fundamentally illegal to engage in this type of activity and behaviour.
Paul Reid was saying that the decryption key has glitches and bugs in it. Have you been given any indication as to when systems might be back?
Well, they're coming back, as I said earlier, in terms of the hospital systems, in terms of the patient administration systems. They are coming back, and the key is helping. And they've worked through that over the weekend, and it is enabling them to get some services back faster. And also, it reduces the risk of the loss of clinical data, which is very important.
Mm. Were you shocked at how vulnerable our system was in the first place?
I've always been of a view that we're vulnerable. And when I became Taoiseach, you know, I would have said to people when I would have met the Gardaí and so on at senior level in terms of broader national security, how are we on cyber security? And what the cyber security experts will say to you is that you have to keep on investing, keep on developing your defences, because those who attack us keep on progressing and keep on advancing their methods and their systems as well.
But they didn't say to you that our entire system is vulnerable to the extent that we have seen over the past week. Were you aware of that?
Our system is always vulnerable to an attack. And there's no foolproof way of resisting such attacks. You know, we did invest and we've continued to invest this year. We've tripled the budget and so on for National Cybersecurity Centre. But we need to do more. Mm-hmm. And we will have to do more because this is the new era of approaches to attack systems and extort.
We had Michael Murphy on this programme last week, the former Deputy Director of Military Intelligence, and he was saying that we have been naive and incoherent for far too long about national security and cyber attacks. Do you accept that? We just didn't do enough.
Well, I think you could argue over the years, could we have moved faster or quicker? I mean, people can have that argument. I think there has been significant investment, certainly in the last while, in relation to cybersecurity. And I think we could do more, we can do more, and we will do more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the people I'm talking to, and I did speak to people, because you know, obviously it's an issue of concern when you're elected Taoiseach, you know, shortly afterwards, I would have said to people, you know, what is Ireland's weaknesses and strengths and resilience in relation to cybersecurity. And what's important is it's not just you're not on your own in relation to cybersecurity. You have to work on a team-based approach. That means across Europe. So, for example, Poland were very helpful in the early phase of this attack because they had suffered something similar. They were familiar with the gang and they immediately...
The same crew attacked their health system.
My understanding is that they would have been familiar with what was going on. They contacted us and were very helpful. UK government was helpful. So people work on a team-based approach, those who were resisting the attacks. So it's not one country on its own. And we will have regular collaboration with international partners and expertise as well.
Will it be up for discussion today when you go to the EU and tomorrow?
Yeah, I will alert to will communicate to my EU colleagues what has transpired and what has happened. And I thank those who have been of assistance to us.
Yeah, who's been of most assistance internationally? Because we've heard about all of these different organisations and countries involved. You mentioned Poland. Anyone else?
I think Poland and the UK have been helpful. Also, the external consultants have been mm-hmm. strong.
When you talk about international...
And also, could I just say, the technology expertise within this country.
Yeah.
Many of the companies rallied around the green
flag. The multinationals.
And came forward and offered personnel and their expertise to support. I mean, there's hundreds of people involved in dealing with this.
There's another way to look at that, though, the international help. Cathal Berry, the independent Kildare TD, saying that Ireland is seen as a freeloader amongst international defence personnel. He says, we expect to be assisted in a crisis, but we're not prepared to invest in our own security.
No, in issues like cybersecurity, I think Cathal would agree, it's a collective, it has to be an international collaboration. It's the only effective way to deal with criminals of this kind, because cybersecurity doesn't know any border. And so we have to pool our resources and pool our expertise and share experiences so that the next attack, the next attack, wherever it takes place, people can respond effectively to it, or else build up defences in advance, having learned from the experiences of this kind.
Do you accept now that there has to be a big spend in the wake of this?
Yes.
To beef up our systems across the board?
Yeah. I mean, we would have tripled it last year, and we would have to, both in terms of the cybersecurity capacity itself, but also in terms of systems. Now, health systems apparently are notoriously open and vulnerable to cybersecurity attacks.
In general or in Ireland?
In general, not just in Ireland. In general, because of the nature of health systems, hospitals, outpatients, scanning equipment and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more exposed in that respect.
So has there been a figure put on it at this stage, how much we'll need to spend?
No, there hasn't been a specific figure, but I think it will be both in terms of strengthening existing systems and also strengthening our cybersecurity capacity. For example, in the Recovery and Resilience Fund, which is available from Europe as part of the recovery after COVID, now we're due to get about €1 billion. We have made submissions in respect of the digital transformation of health to continue to accelerate that, because we will be from the electronic perspective, you know, health needs to move forward. I think we've learned good lessons through COVID-19 in terms of the very rapid acceleration of technology and its application to health services. That will continue, and we will be investing more in our health service from the IT perspective.
So you don't accept that we were vulnerable before this happened?
Sorry, we're always vulnerable.
Yeah.
We are always vulnerable.
But you're sort of saying we were vulnerable, but through no fault of our own, even though we've had senior medics on here saying that we have a system that is, some of it's inherited from the old health board system. We don't have the universal health numbers. There's a lot of work that could be done.
Personally, I've been of a view for a long time that we have to invest far more in our health system from a digital and electronic perspective. And we've been too slow at that. We can modernise our health service far more and far more effectively, and it's an aim of mine and of the government to do that, and to use every available means at our disposal to modernise our health service from the digital perspective. I think we're making progress, and I think the COVID experience, I think, will accelerate that. The lessons to be learned from COVID, the challenges, and what we should do is embed those lessons into the system, into the future.
But we probably should have been doing it years ago.
We should have been, yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to exiting lockdown now, because the mood music around this is good. We're told you'll have more announcements on Friday. But this big dark cloud on the horizon, the so-called Indian variant, genuine concern in Neffat about this. Will you adapt the reopening plan to take this into account, those concerns into account?
In relation to the Indian variant?
Yes.
We will. I think, first of all, the reopening plan so far is working. It's been cautious. It's been gradual. But, you know, our schools have come back. Construction has come back. Retail has come back. Various sporting activities are back. And all of that so far hasn't resulted in any spikes of significance. And so far, so good in terms of the reopening of society. Now, we did say we would look at hospitality, and we've indicated for the second for hotels and that, and B&Bs and guest houses, and then the seventh for outdoor dining and outdoor drinking. What we'd like to do next week is to outline what is possible, what we feel is possible for June and July in respect of travel, for example, in respect, furthermore, of hospitality and indeed live entertainment and the arts. We may trial some events in June and then see what's possible in July. But we will take Neffat's advice, and that'll come Thursday. We are conscious of the variant. We don't want to, we've made such good progress now. There's no point in throwing that away.
Because given what we've heard about this variant and how it interacts with the vaccine, we only have 15% of our population fully vaccinated at this stage. So, I mean, caution must be the watchword here.
Absolutely, a caution has to be there's no question about that, and we will be cautious, but we are making rapid progress on the vaccination. You're correct, it's 15% fully vaccinated, 45%, over 45% now have received the first dose. The good news is that, yes, if you're at the two-dose vaccines, both RNA and AstraZeneca, do give protection against the Indian variant. But your point is a valid point, and we will be taking that into consideration.
Because looking at Pfizer and AstraZeneca, Public Health England saying that after the first dose of both, 33% effective against the Indian variant. So you can see how we could land ourselves in big trouble here if we're not careful.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have to be careful as we proceed here. And we've a lot of challenges on the economic front. And you can see where the aviation industry is in trouble and has been in trouble for quite some time because of the impact of COVID. And again, but I've said consistently throughout this particular reopening process that whatever we reopen, we want to keep open. We don't want to jeopardize the overall situation. And that will be the guiding principle here. So, it's steady as she goes up to the end of this month. It'll be steady in June. We'll see what's possible in July.
OK, and given the prevalence of this Indian variant, so-called, in the UK, should we be considering mandatory hotel quarantine of people arriving from there?
Well, we'd have to take, again, advice in relation to that. I think there's a balance to be struck here. I mean, as you know, the UK can fly into Northern Ireland. And I think we're saying to people at the moment, you know, essential travel, avoid non-essential travel. But we are going to participate in the EU Green Digital Certificate. Mm-hmm. There will be an emergency break within that framework for any variants. But I think there has to be a gradual roadmap given to the aviation industry that's important. And I think people need to have some idea over the next number of months what is envisaged.
Eamon Ryan said now that hotel quarantine will have to change to focus on variants. So that if you take that at face value, that would mean the UK.
Yeah, we'll take public health advice in relation to all of these matters. But the variant is the key issue in terms of hotel mandatory quarantining. And in many ways has been from the outset. There are other criteria as well that is used, mm-hmm. In terms of decision making and public health advice from it. But again, we'll monitor what's happening in the UK also in terms of the spread of that Indian variant. But it is an issue that we are monitoring very, very closely.
I know it's a really big step to do that, to consider that. But if NEFID said to you that you should be looking at mandatory hotel quarantine on arrivals from Britain, if you don't take that advice, you're arguably putting at risk all of those steps that you outlined there, from the schools reopening right through to retail reopening in recent days.
But I'm not going to speculate on whether we would or wouldn't. We have to obviously take any public health advice as it comes and engage with public health advice in relation to issues of that kind. But we did ban, for example, I remember during Christmas, for a short term, and there are limits to what you can do in terms of banning flights in and out of any particular jurisdiction. And there's very strong legal
We're not talking about banning issues. Flights, though.
No, I know, but I thought perhaps you were implying that there in terms of UK. You're saying hotel mandatory quarantining. There are still very significant tests that have to be passed in relation to that. As we know from creating this structure in the first place, there were a lot of legal considerations around that in terms of people's personal liberties and so forth. So it would be a very big, big step. But again, we will monitor it. I think they're a bit more confident in the UK now in respect of the Indian variant maybe than they were in terms of its impact on severe illness and death.
If you're fully vaccinated.
If you're vaccinated.
And we're just not there yet.
Well, we're not. And look, we're not doing anything in a hurry here. I mean, let's be clear, we've been cautious and we've been attacked for being too cautious, and we're being criticised by different sectors across society for being too cautious. But steady as it goes is how we are going to approach this. And there will be an effort meeting on Thursday. There'll be a cabinet COVID subcommittee meeting on Thursday evening, cabinet on Friday. And we'll assess the situation then when we have more data coming in respect of.
And your plan is still to make a big announcement on Friday?
Well, it's an announcement in respect of further progress in June and July and how we see things. Because we do need to give people in certain sectors some idea of
what's happening. Because the publicans are calling for a full reopening of indoor dining on the 1st of July.
Yeah, but I think people need just to hold it. I can understand people from different sectors. They're suffering a lot. They've had a huge negative impact. They've lost a lot of income. They haven't worked. Many, many people want to get back to work in these sectors. Mm-hmm. And without question, that sector, hospitality, tourism, travel, has suffered the most.
But it sounds like you're not going to be able to give them a commitment on the 1st of July.
No, we'll make a comprehensive statement next week in terms of timelines and so forth. But the basic theme has been...
You mean Friday?
I'll be making a statement on after government meeting. Government will make decisions around this. For the summer, outdoor is best. bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Indoor, you know, has been challenging for this virus from the get-go. So I think let's make the progress we are making. Let's continue to make it. That gives everybody the best guarantee of a more sustained opening into the future. If you rush it too quickly, you can end up in some.
And given what we went through at Christmas, I would imagine you would be reluctant to say now that we should be indoors dining this summer.
Well, I'm saying, look, again, I'll be making a comprehensive statement that arises around the government decisions on Friday. We'll be guided by public health on this. But so far, I think we're making good progress that we're doing what we're doing in the beginning of June. Let's see how that unfolds, how that materialises. You know, we'll have outdoor dining, outdoor drinking from the 7th of June onwards. We will have the hotels being guest houses available from the 2nd of June for people to book.
Mm-hmm.
And see how that impacts then on the disease and so
leave that for a number of weeks and then perhaps move on the 1st of July.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens during July.
Okay.
If you look at what we've been doing from May, April and May, everything wasn't on the first week of those particular months when we began to reopen. So full retail was the 17th of May. So it's a gradual approach we will be adopting.
Okay, and cautious.
And cautious.
Sporting events, talk of having 25, 30,000 people in Croke Park for the All-Ireland. Can you see that happening?
Look, I think we have to, as I say, make hay slowly. I think let's take it step by step. Let's see how the impact of this variant work out. We will, you know, by the time the All-Irelands will be played, you know, we will have advanced vaccination much more significantly then. But again, I'm not getting into specifics in terms of numbers. I mean, some people are speculating around those numbers. Again, a cautious approach will apply there.
Okay. And then aviation, the Irish Airline Pilots Association saying that thousands of jobs could be lost if we don't get a plan in place to restart aviation. We had that hammer blow to Shannon last week. When will we expect to get aviation back? Is there a plan right now?
Yeah, well, that's what we intend to do. We will be discussing this week, and at the end of the week, we will make a statement in relation to aviation. That will be part of the statement. We're acutely aware of how severely impacted aviation has been, how challenging it has been for the airlines. Ireland depends on connectivity as an open, small open economy, and therefore we will, we will have to give indications to the industry from a timeline perspective as to when they can start planning to fly again. Now, I think the EU travel framework will give a context to all of this, because that's been.
This is the digital cert thing that we'll have,
And that's been the Commission and the Parliament. And the council are working on the basis of facilitating the freedom of movement within the European Union.
Mandatory hotel quarantine and that digital cert, how will that work?
Well, I think it'll have to adjust in relation to it. But again,
we'll have to get rid of it, will we, for EU citizens?
But I think Europe is making progress in any event, and many EU member states may come off that in a natural way as progress is made against the virus across Europe. But there will the EU framework will, over time, and become the overarching policy framework for within the European Union.
What did you make of what Aer Lingus did in Shannon last week, closing the crew base permanently? Was that a cynical move, or was it related to what's been happening over the course of COVID? Because they were given a lot of state assistance in terms of that loan at Christmas.
I wasn't happy with it. I think we have given a lot of support to the airlines. They are burning a lot of cash, to be fair. I think it's a cost move by Aer Lingus. That is what they are saying. We've made it very clear to Aer Lingus the importance of regional growth in Ireland and the regional economy as a counterbalance to the continued growth of Dublin. So Shannon Airport is extremely important in that regard.
And what
we've invested
Cork?
In Shannon, we've invested in Cork,
both
capital funding. We will continue to do that. I think the government is very, very clear, and we will work with the aviation industry. We'll work with the airports and the airlines to reboot aviation when it's safe to do so, and to work with everybody to make sure we can have a sustained recovery for aviation, because connectivity is very important.
You must be concerned about Cork, though. Aer Lingus in Cork.
No, I'm concerned about aviation more generally. Obviously in terms of the Cork situation, there's a temporary decision made because of the runway work that's underway there, which is good work in terms of, that's part of the investment we've made so that the runway can be extended and invested in Cork, which had to happen. But if you look at the URDF, the Urban Regeneration Funding, over 1.2 billion was allocated. Limerick, Cork, Waterford, those cities we want to grow. That's part of the National Spatial Plan and 2040. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we want to grow the cities. And to grow the cities, we need international connectivity. So Cork and Shannon. And Shannon is extremely important to the Western Seaboard from a tourism point of view, from an industry FDI point of view. And so we will be focusing very strongly in terms of the National Economic Recovery Plan on aviation, on connectivity, and providing more sustained supports to enable that to recover after COVID.
And Aer Lingus hasn't given you any indication that they want out of those places and to focus on Dublin.
No, the contrary. They're saying, look, they're very committed. They're saying to operations at Shannon, they're very committed to getting business back up and running. Basically, Aer Lingus are saying that the COVID has had an enormous impact on them, notwithstanding the supports they've got from government, and that this is the rationale for what they're doing. So from our perspective then, we've already provided through eWIS and the wage subsidy schemes and through the investment in the airports significant supports.
Okay, but it wasn't enough for those 81 jobs.
They're still losing very significant amounts of money on a daily basis, and that's why for them, obviously, they want aviation and travel restored as quickly as possible. And that's the balance government has to always continually make here in terms of public health, but also real economic issues now in terms of jobs in the region and jobs in for pilots aviation industry more generally.
I want to talk to you about
Sorry
to interrupt you. I want to talk to you about housing because at Cabinet, after Cabinet, it was reported that the Taoiseach took issue with you describing housing as the government's number one priority. Are you on the same page about how serious that problem is?
Oh, yes, the government is in no doubt about how serious this issue is for people out there who need to get access to housing, be it social housing, be it affordable housing.
But he was he did raise an issue, didn't he?
I don't discuss what goes on at cabinet meetings, and you'll get various leaks and so on like that.
Everyone else does, but anyway.
Sorry?
Everyone else discusses it.
Well, I don't. I don't think it's. But I mean, there's many conversations go on at cabinet. But what I can say to you, the three party leaders and the entire cabinet, get the centrality of housing to people's lives.
I mean, it was a big issue about that, right? Now let's because cabinet. Okay, we don't. You don't talk about that. That's fine. But Leo Varadkar sent an email to his party where he said family homelessness is down. He was comparing the situation now to what it was in 2011. Family homelessness is down 40%. It's a different housing crisis from 2011. Things like falling home values, negative equity and ghost estates have all been largely resolved. Do you disagree with him on that?
I think it's a very serious issue now in terms of, first of all, we're not building enough houses. Last year, we built about 20,000 houses. ESRI are saying we should build 33 per annum. I think it could be higher than that now because of what we've lost during COVID.
But you're in government with somebody who says this is not as bad as it was in 2011.
I'm not so sure Leo was saying that. I think he's in no doubt about how serious the housing issue is. We've had a range of, we've had a series of cabinet subcommittees on housing, all with a focus on bringing new initiatives. And to be fair to Minister Dara Brian, new initiatives are coming on board in terms of affordability. But we have to do more in terms of both the financial model around housing and also in terms of using every available arm of the state to deal with this housing crisis. Because the younger generation need to aspire, not just aspire to home ownership, but realise that aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, the state is the only main player, really. When the state is embarking on a major social housing programme, wanting to do about 50,000 over the next 5 years. The state is now getting involved directly in building affordable housing. The state's getting involved in investing in the infrastructure to facilitate house construction. We're bringing in legislation for the Land Development Agency to get public lands into play for housing.
Will it happen quickly enough, though? That's the frustration, isn't it?
We're moving heaven and hell. Yes, the Land Agency Bill has been around for a number of years. We've moved very quickly in the last number of months to get that into the Dáil. It's there, and we will get that through before the summer recess. We've got to move quickly in respect of this. And there's too much opposing everything within the political system as well. Mm. And it does take too long in some respects.
It's just
either to get projects shovel-ready, or indeed in terms of getting legislation through as well.
And the planning process as well.
Yes.
And objections.
Yes, that's what I mean. Mm-hmm. And also, even within councils, they can procrastinate around the model that should go into a particular project, the housing mix, so to speak. And my view, if there's potential of 900 houses being built, if they get the green light to start, we should give them the green light to start.
So how do you rip through all of that, if that's what you believe should happen?
Well, I think that's the role of government, and we're moving in terms of the legislation. I think the Land Development Agency will be important and will give us an extra leverage to get moving more quickly. I think we have to reform planning as well to make it more efficient. I think we have to put more resources into Bord Pleanála to make sure that they have the resources to make their decisions resilient and more robust in terms of any challenges that come to various projects. I think I'm very clear that all departments in government have to be a part of the resolving of this issue. It's not just the Department of Housing.
And does Leo Varadkar accept that?
He does. He does. Yeah.
Okay. on the stamp duty issue, when it came to the bulk buying of properties and the investment funds, it's just interesting that it was 10% was the figure picked. Whereas if government really wanted to stop that practice, you would have gone to 25%. Richard Curran was making the point in the Sunday Independent yesterday. If you really wanted to close that door, you would have firmly slammed it in the face of the investment funds. 10% probably doesn't do that.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, Pascal Donohue is of a view, and he obviously would have worked with his team of officials and others, that it will have impact. And it's a broader measure than in the UK, and it affects not just the funds, but all multiple purchasers of houses and duplexes. And I think the combination of measures will have an impact. In respect of apartments in cities, and this goes back to the point I made about financing and the capacity of builders to get your money at a reasonable price to start building, there is a need still to keep supply up. And the fear was that on the apartment side, we could reduce supply in the short term if we'd applied it to apartments, for example.
Yeah, I suppose the message has gone out now that investment funds are welcome here. You know, they are welcome, and we need them as part of our house building programme, you know?
Well, certainly in terms of apartment blocks, in high-density apartment blocks in cities. I mean, I even heard, Ona Brin of Sinn Féin say one thing in the Dáil, Mary Lewis, but Ona Brin will say there's a role for investment funds. He said it in prime time last week. I found it quite an interesting observation by him, because given the degree to which Sinn Féin were building this up for the last number of weeks, there is a role, but it has to be targeted, and it has to be an appropriate role. We do not want them competing with first-time buyers or people who wish to be owner-occupiers of houses. And over time, I think we've got to create a financial model that enables builders, small builders, medium-sized builders, to borrow money at a reasonable cost to start projects. There's a broader piece of work needed there also. And I think we have to work on all fronts. And to me, it is the key issue facing us. I'm in no doubt that this is the key issue.
You've by-election coming up, and Dublin Bay South, Fianna Fáil published a campaign video yesterday. I'm sure you saw it. And the theme tune was Mission Impossible. What kind of a message does that send out?
Well, it got well noticed.
Is it Mission Impossible?
No, nothing is Mission Impossible in any by-election. And Deirdre Conroy is a good candidate for us. I think the convention will be formally tomorrow night, and I've worked with Deirdre in local elections. Has had very significant, contribution herself in terms of public policy in respect to the Eighth Amendment, for example, but also in terms of her work in terms of preservation of streetscapes and her professional competency in terms of conservation and so on. So I think we're a very competent, very capable candidate. And by-elections are notoriously difficult to call. Personalities emerge during the dynamic of a campaign. So it will be an interesting campaign. Yeah.
And Director of Elections is Jim O'Callaghan.
Absolutely.
A man who we think and suspect would like your job. Gave him a hospital pass there, did you?
No, I think Jim was very anxious to work as Director of Elections as well. And I think given his experience in the constituency, and he is the TD for the constituency, he knows it well over many, many years. So
he's under pressure, though, isn't he, to perform here now?
It's a bottom line. We're going to do the very best we can in relation to this by-election. We will work very hard. I think many people from within the party will rally to the cause. We'll give everything we have.
Okay.
And
Just to return to Belarus for a moment, because there's a statement on the wires just as we've been talking here. The authorities in Belarus have insisted now that they acted legally when they diverted a passenger plane carrying an opposition activist. They've accused the West of making unfounded claims for political reasons. Their foreign ministry spokesperson said there's no doubt that the actions of our competent authorities fully met established international rules. The West is politicising the situation. What do you say to that?
No, I think this is nonsense. I think we all know what happened here. And don't be hiding behind rules or don't be hiding behind sort of, you know, excuses. You forced the plane down to arrest an opposition, not opposition, a journalist whose views you don't agree with. Mm-hmm. And you arrested that individual. And that just is contrary to any sense of human decency or democratic values. You know, I worry about the growth of authoritarianism in the world. And you know, we have it in Belarus. Lukashenko and his regime have been cracking down on people, and it's not acceptable. And democratic mm-hmm. countries have to stand up against this, because there's a creeping sense of we can do what we like here and keep on going.
Have you spoken to Michael O'Leary about this, by the way?
No, I haven't. No,
yeah. He was on News Talk this morning, yeah. And he said that they believe that there were KGB agents on that plane. Do you have any reason to doubt that? Did you have any information on it?
Well, all I have is that I think five people didn't get back on that plane. No, there is speculation that they could have been Secret Service personnel as well, but I don't have specific or definitive information.
So five people didn't get on. It would have been Roman Protasevich, his partner, and possibly three KGB agents.
That's just what I was told before I came on here. But I mean, that can vary and that can change, as you know. These are not definitive.
Taoiseach, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.